I'm Mark O'Connor. I'm here with Dr. Diana Dreyer. It's September 22nd, 2008. We're in the Bailey Library, and we're about to do some interviews. And interview with Dr. Dreyer. Awesome. Thank you for coming up.
You're welcome.
All right, here's the really boring stuff. Can you give us your name, date of birth, if you want, where you're from, and your education background?
Okay. My full name is Diana Yvonne Dreyer. My dad called me Diana because he thought I was going to be a moon goddess, and he liked the French language, so that's where the Yvonne came from. My birthday, I'm 2 weeks short of 70th. Where I came from, I was born in Chicago, Illinois, on the north side, but my parents moved to the south side just before my second birthday, I think. And that was about a mile away from where the infamous Reverend Wright's church is,
wow.
Which is so much in the news.
Do you go back to Chicago much?
Yeah, I go back. Well, I used to go back just about every year, but now my family's pretty much gone. Actually, some of them live down in Peoria, so I have a Peoria connection there, too. And I still have a lot of friends in Chicago, so I try to go back and see them at least every other year.
Nice. Your education background.
Okay.
What kind of learning do you get?
I graduated from Illinois State Normal University in 1960 with a Bachelor of Science degree in education in English. You asked before about the normal. No, it's not normal anymore. They took it out in the early 60s. We also used to have, the motto of the school was, and gladly would he learn, and gladly teaching. And they have since taken out the old English and converted it to modern English, which I think kind of takes the charm away. But, what are you going to do? So, then I taught high school and junior high English for several years and started having babies and didn't go back to school until 1982 and went to IUP, earned a master's there, and then eventually a PhD, also from IUP, Indiana University of Pennsylvania. I guess I should say that. Can I use abbreviations here?
Sure.
Okay.
Because we'll explain them in the transcript also.
Okay.
If you need to. How did you get from Illinois to here, to Pennsylvania?
Well, as I said, I graduated in 1960, and as women did then, we got married right away. So I got married and started putting my husband through master's degrees and doctor's degrees and moved around from Illinois. First taught in Atlanta, Illinois. Most people don't know there is Atlanta, Illinois, but it's on Old Route 66, about 20 miles from Normal. Then I went to St. Charles, Illinois and taught junior high for 1 year and then moved out to Colorado for my husband's terminal degree program. And taught in Bald, Colorado. And then we moved back to Southern Illinois. So I taught at East Alton Wood River while he taught at Southern Illinois University. Then we came to Slippery Rock because he didn't like his job at Southern. I got an offer here at Slippery Rock, so here's where we moved in 1965. And I've been here ever since.
So what did you
think?
However,
the husband is no longer here. Well, he's here, but he's not with me.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what did you think of Slippery Rock? The name and the idea of it and all that?
Okay. This is my favorite Slippery Rock story. As I mentioned, I was from Chicago. So, and while I had, taught in small towns and actually lived in Normal, which is a fairly small town for a while, I wasn't exactly prepared for Slippery Rock. And we were getting directions as to how to get here from the former chair of the phys ed department, who was Bill Meisey. He'd been here quite a while. He and his wife, Maggie, were quite active in Slippery Rock University, well, Slippery Rock State College then, affairs. Anyway, he was on the phone giving directions to my ex-husband, and my ex-husband was writing these directions down, okay, turn here, go here, take this route, whatever. And they said, okay, turn at the stoplight. And then he said, which stoplight? And of course, Bill Meisey said, the stoplight, because at that time there was just the one at Main Street and 108. So that was a jolt, and I just found a lot of jolts. I had a baby right after we came here, and I didn't have a washer or dryer, so I used to come in town to do my laundry, which is the laundromat was where, can't think of what's in there now. Anyway, on Main Street. And I just was fascinated by the culture of the laundromat because, first of all, if I happened to go on one particular day, which I sort of think was on a Tuesday, these very elegantly dressed local women would come in and play bridge. And they were all dressed up. I mean, they even, I think some in my memory had hats on, and they'd go in the back room and play bridge in the laundromat. And I never could figure out why they were doing that, because at least one of them I knew had a very elegant home. I guess she chose not to entertain. The laundromat was run by a guy that they called Sudsy. And I later found out that Rennick, who is now being, you know, Rennick Plumbing, well, the original Rennick guy, he was Leaky the plumber, and Sudsy the laundromat owner. And all these guys used to hang out at Isley's, which was a place where you could get Chip Chop ham, which I had never heard of, so that was a new thing for me. Do you know Chip Chop ham?
No,
you're exactly giving me this blank look. I was trying to explain this to some friends from Illinois. You just have to have it. It's like a big ham loaf, and when you order it, you get a Chip Chop. I don't know why they call it that. It's sliced very, very thin. You can get some at Giant Eagle.
Is it processed? Like,
yeah, probably. It's probably very unhealthy, but you know, boy, it makes a good sandwich. And like the old hot dog shop used to make Chip Chop ham. Barbecue, they, you know, fry it up. Another not so healthy thing, but sure tasted good. Anyway, Isley's had all the old Silver Rock Guard, and they had their own table in the back of Isley's. And woe betide anybody who inadvertently walked up and sat at their table because we'd get removed. Because that table belonged to them.
Where was Isley's?
Isley's, I'm trying to think. There's a beauty salon downtown, hair salon. I'm dating myself. I almost call it a beauty parlor, but you don't say that anymore. You say salon, okay, hair salon. Right around Cafaro's Pizza, along that stretch, yeah. Where there also used to be, you know, a couple of little department stores. And,
really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bard's department store was near, well, there used to be a pharmacy down there, Ord's, which everybody, has nobody told you any of this? Good for you, Mark, you need to know this history.
I've only been here 5 years.
Yeah, anyway, Ord's pharmacy was where Gallery 164 was. You remember where that is, which is now some kind of a wildlife office or something. I don't even know what's in there. Anyway, I think next door to that, going north, was Bard's department store. And it had, you know, notion, what they used to call notions, threads and needles and socks and boots and clothing and mittens and shoes, just all kinds of things. And it had one of those, which there was a department store in Chicago that used to have this, where when you paid your money for your purchase, mm-hmm. The cashier took the money and put it in a container like you do at a drive-in bank, and whooshed it upstairs, and then all the money was taken care of back in the upper level of the store. And then it came whooshing down with your change if you had any change. That was kind of funny.
So when did these stores start going out of business? Because now it's mostly pizza joints and, you know,
haircut places. Yeah, there was a nice little dress shop down there too, which is Gray's hair salon now. They had very nice clothing, run by a couple of local women. But I would say once, like Butler started to fail, the downtown, it's just like every small town could not support or chose not to support, I think because of the big box stores, and the students used to stay here during the weekend, and they would support all different kinds of things, businesses downtown, but they just started going away for the weekend, and so there's not the business, just not the support for business. In fact, there used to be a nice Hallmark store downtown where the Taekwondo place is now. And that woman held out for several years, and she finally said she was going to be closed. And I said, oh, that's too bad. You know, it's so convenient to have a Hallmark store. And she said, Hallmark stores do, I don't know what she said, like 60 or 70% of their business at Christmas. She said, I have no Christmas business because everybody leaves. So, just, you know, because the population not coming to college or Super Rec is very small.
When did you see the shift from kids sticking around to taking off when it began?
You know, that's a good question. I started teaching in 1980. I would say during the 80s, and I don't know, probably started in the 70s. I don't know. I'm not sure. But definitely in the 80s.
And what made them take off? And
I think the refrain, which is continue here, there's nothing to do here. Well, of course, the businesses can't stay in business unless the students support them, so, you know, it's like a catch-22.
You said you started in 1980. What department?
In the English department. I started as a quarter-time temporary. I taught one course of college writing. At that time, the Vice President for Academic Affairs, Bob Ebersole, was very interested in getting what he called experienced high school teachers who could really teach college writing. I mean, I hadn't taught for 15 years, and that's quite debatable as to what I was doing the first couple of years. You know. However, you know, he hired me and Ann Dayton, whom you may remember. And so we were the experienced high school teachers. I started out quarter time. I think Ann was the same one. And then eventually, like the next year, maybe went to half time and then three quarter. Anyway, I finally got a tenure track position in 1984.
4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, what was the department like back then?
Can I be frank? Personally, I was sort of out of it. My first year, I think I was housed. Jerry O'Malley was on sabbatical. I don't know if you remember Jerry O'Malley. Was part of the English department, and for whatever reasons, his office was in the philosophy department. This is when the English department was housed in Eisenberg, as was philosophy. So I had Jerry's desk while he was on sabbatical, so I was far removed from the English department, and the philosophy people just pretty much, I mean, I knew them because I'd been here for 15 years, but I was just like, oh, what? Here's this person who's coming and teaching a class, and nobody paid too much attention. So, anyway, there was then Bill Williams and Jim Strickland came on board. Bill in 81, Jim in 82 or 83, and some other younger people. I mean, it wasn't that we were kids by any means, but there was kind of differences. There were differences of opinion as to how to teach English. Particularly how to teach writing. So there was sort of a schism between the old guard and Ed Copper, who was probably, I think he was younger than I am. He would always call us the Young Turks, you know. So anyway, there were lots of interesting department discussions and how things should be. And of course, you know, Bill Williams is extraordinary debater. He can argue beautifully, and there was lots of interesting discussion back then.
How big was the department back then?
It was big, because we've always had that huge load of the college writing classes. So it was probably in the high 20s. I would say the complement hasn't really changed hugely over the years.
So the Young Turks went out, or the old guard ultimately on the whole teaching and writing?
You're a Young Turk, so you can sort of determine that. I think the older Turks were literature trained. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of them referred to me as an old schoolmarm and an NCTE-er, which the way he said it was not a compliment because I was not part of the Modern Language Association, MLA. So I was sort of looked down upon by some of the literature.
So like a curse word, NCTE?
Oh, yeah.
It's a four-letter word.
Yeah. Wow. It's nasty. So, but the literature people, while they, I'm sure, did a beautiful job of teaching literature, had no sense of how people write. I mean, they knew how they wrote, but they demanded different things of their students. So we had in place at, during those times, the Almighty Proficiency Test. I don't know if you've heard about the Proficiency Test. And College Writing 1 students would have to take this, and they had to keep taking it until they passed it. So one semester, I had a night class that Steve Curry, who was then assistant chair and making the schedule. And again, I was a flunky, you know, I'd have done anything to keep my job. Would you mind teaching a course, a night course of 25 students, all of whom have failed the proficiency at least twice? Oh, sure, I'd do it, you know. So we did it, and I used Newsweek for the first time that semester, which they seemed to enjoy, and I just remember a couple of covers on it. There was an AIDS cover.
Wow.
And that's the first time, that would have been in 81, I believe, maybe 82. It's the first time I ever really had heard about AIDS. I guess maybe I'd heard of it, but that's the first time I really read about it. And I always kind of associate AIDS, and there was another one that was on the American Dream, and we talked a lot about what the American Dream was. Anyway, the good news is all but one of those kids passed that proficiency. I have no idea why. I mean, it was just luck on my part, but everybody thought, oh, good job.
How did it feel when you got hired full-time?
Oh, I was ecstatic. I had gone through a very difficult divorce from 81 to 83, and of course was very concerned about being able to earn a living. I have three daughters, and they sort of wanted food, clothing, shelter, and all those things, lots of clothes mostly. So I was very happy to have what I hoped was, and what turned out to be a very secure position.
So here's sort of the global question. How have you seen the department changing in your time here? Because you retired just a couple of years after I came in.
Mm-hmm. Fall of 06.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think...
Or has it?
You know, I don't really... Because, well, in 2001, as you may know, I went over and became assistant to the dean.
Mm-hmm. The dark side.
So I was teaching only one course a semester. So, and that was usually a night course by my choice, young adult lit, and I don't remember what the other one was. Anyway, so I really wasn't around the department that much. And then I did, my last semester I did teach full time, but again, that was so, I hadn't taught full time for so long, I found that very demanding, more demanding than being in the dean's office, the assistant to the dean.
Really?
Oh, the paper load. You know,
yeah.
That's, I don't know, I could say this now, but now that I'm interim dean, I go home at night, I have no papers to grade. I go home on Fridays, I have no papers to grade. It's like, wow, now I see why people go to administration. You know, it's nice.
Have the class sizes changed?
Class sizes, they did a good job of up to a certain point of keeping College Writing 1 and 2 down to 25. And I think that's going to be up at 27. Although I will tell you one time I taught, I guess the administration, or maybe it was the department, decided we're going to try jumbo classes. So I had 45 students in College Writing, as did I think three other faculty members. It was an experiment. And I had an assistant, Joan Force, who was the wife of George Force, who used to do institutional review, and he was part of the political science department as well. So she was terrific. I mean, at 45 in College Writing seemed terrible, and it was terrible, but still, you know, we muddled through it, but everybody decided it wasn't a very good idea. So that was just for one semester. However, during another period, they had, and I can't remember exactly how this worked, but four faculty members would each have 25 in class, but they would meet those classes only once a week, say, and then the other two meetings, or perhaps only one meeting, they would go to a lecture on, say, the con,
well,
which was fascinating, as you can well imagine, or sometimes we talked about the semicolon, you know, for an hour, or I guess more than an hour. It was a Tuesday, Thursday class, and this these lectures, of course, dramatically changed student writing. It just became
In
Pulitzer Prize potential, not only kidding.
In retrospect, how did the hour lecture on the commas strike you?
It was absurd. It struck me as absurd back then, but you know, that as that was back in the day when there was this literature group who thought that was the way to teach writing. You tell people
mechanics.
About mechanics. And that was the whole basis of the proficiency test, you know. Three commas voices and you're out. Never mind what you said, it could have been, you know, the most lyrical, lovely phrasing in the world, but it's a comma spliced or, you know, lacked a comma where there should have been, and, you know, we all know how fuzzy those comma rules are anyway. It was a joke.
Wow, horrifying. Let's see. What else do we have? So many questions here. Here's a goofy question. What buildings did you work in? You said you had an office in Eisenberg.
Yeah, I worked in Eisenberg. Actually, I taught a college writing course once in the music department over in Swope because Spots was so full. By that time, we moved from Eisenberg to Spots. Not very happily, let me tell you.
How come?
Oh, you look at the size of the hallway, the width of the hallways in Eisenberg, and then you look at the width of the hallways in Spots. That was one reason. We had much nicer offices over there, because now I realize that the English department has very cushy offices, comparatively speaking. But
well, the new ones.
The new ones, right. But back in that day, I mean, we gave up a lot. We had our own little kitchen. We had our own lounge. And, of course, for years we didn't have a lounge after we moved to Spots. So, yeah, we were not happy about that. But anyway, so I taught a class in the music building in Eisenberg in Spots, and also in one time I taught just for a while, then we moved it. I think that was when I moved to the music building. I was over in the cave, which was a real hype just for one class. But I think that's the one that moved back over to the music building. And then, of course, I've been in BSB as the assistant to a dean, and now as interim dean.
Do you have a preference from all those buildings?
I guess Eisenberg in a lot of ways. That was when I was really young and dumb and having fun.
A question about campus activities. Did you work in any clubs or faculty advisor committees or any other channels?
Oh, God, I've been on lots of committees. You know, just about every department committee. In terms of the university, I was on the university curriculum committee, the university promotion committee, which I chaired. University tenure and sabbatical. I served as a faculty advisor to the co-op activity board for several years, AFSCUP department rep for many years. I should have brought my resume over, so my CV, and then I would remember all this stuff. Yeah.
Any stand out as interesting or particularly fun or useful?
Well, I first served on the curriculum committee, and the university curriculum committee. I thought that was really interesting. I had that really opened my eyes to A, how academia really works, and B, what kinds of offerings all the different colleges and departments have. That was very interesting. And the promotion committee was interesting too. And, got into a couple of snags with some difficult faculty member situations.
Would you like to talk about a snag?
I don't think I should. You
don't have to mention names.
No, just people trying to get around the rules and regulations. People who yell and scream long enough tend to do that successfully, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. What you said you learned about how the university academia works from the university curriculum committee.
Well, how what academics work, I should
yeah.
say.
What did you not know before you were on that committee?
Oh, I was really stupid. I got elected to that committee, I think probably shortly after I was on the tenure track. So it would have been in the early, mid-80s. And I just didn't know how things worked. And that's how I learned how a lot of things worked. How to get courses through, accommodate situations where one department's change might impact another, either really impact it or have a perceived impact on it, and then you'd have to go through all these gyrations to get things through. It was interesting.
Yeah.
A lot of faculty personalities, too. Are we okay?
We're definitely okay in the video. Let's see what else. The teaching stuff, all the teaching you did. You have a best moment or a couple best moments you want to talk about, or not so best moments?
I can tell you one not so best moment, and it has to do with videotaping. While I was in graduate school at IUP, I met and developed a friendship with a professor at Clarion, Darlene Fink, and she and I were both working on our dissertations together. And she decided she wanted to do something with English as a second language because we were both interested in second language acquisition. So at that time, I had devised with the international office to teach my college writing classes with half international students and half native speakers of English. And there's a story behind that. I don't know how much time we have.
As much as you want.
Okay. I had, at one point, all the international students in one class, which was great. I mean, they were in a couple classes. They weren't, we had more than one class.
What countries were they from?
Oh, you name it. They were all over the place. South America, all over Europe, Asian. We had a very significant international population prior to 9/11. It's dropped off since then for a variety of reasons, which you probably know. But anyway, I had these international students. Was at one point, and they loved it because that was their kind of their club meeting. You know, they all got together and jabbered away in all their various languages. And of course, all I know is about that much Spanish. So, but anyway, it was good. But I had trouble kind of reining them in sometimes because they were so happy to see each other and get caught up. And at one semester, there inadvertently arrived a native speaker in that class, Elise. And Elise was a very good student. Elise was very intimidated by those international students. But by the end of the semester, she said that she had learned so much about the world. I don't know what she learned about writing, but she was already a writer, which is, you know, part of becoming a writer anyway, just learning stuff. So anyway. So I talked to Stan Kajorski, who happened to be a neighbor of mine and was then head of the international office, and said, you know, I think it'd be a good idea if we created these half and half classes so that, you know, the international students would learn from the native speakers more about their English, the native speakers would learn more about other lands and other ways, other cultures and so forth. So that worked out great. Well, to get back to Darlene Fink, my friend from Clarion, she asked me if I would be willing to videotape X number of, I don't know, I think you did the whole semester of classes, which she was then going to study for, I don't remember what she was going to do with those videotapes, but that was her dissertation data. I said, sure, no problem. So we got the tapes going, and one day I had a new outfit on, and I thought, I look particularly spiffy on the camera today, you know, and so we were taping away, and everything went very well. That was a good take for Darlene. After the end of the class, this one kind of soft-spoken young woman from Germany came up and said, Professor Dreyer, your trousers are open. So that was probably my worst teaching moment. Here I was performing for the camera with my flyover.
Do you have a couple ones that on the opposite end of the spectrum?
Oh, gosh. You know, my last semester, I had three college writing classes, and I hadn't taught three sections of writing for a long time, and I was kind of dreading it, and as I said, the paper load, as you well know, is monumental. But at the end of the semester, the last day of class, all the students were, oh, don't leave, you know, because I told them I was retiring. Anyway, they brought in Kate, refreshments and drinks, and we had a party, and they planned the whole thing, and I just thought, you know, that was so, so great. And I really do miss being around the students now. Don't miss the paperwork at all. And I never minded reading their papers, I just hated responding to them, you know? So, that was a good moment.
Did you figure out any tricks for grading? This is mostly a question I'm asking.
No, no. I, believe me, I read every book and every article about, you know, don't be a slave to your papers, and I really tried to do all that, and, you know, set up score sheets and, you know, every kind of thing I could. But by and large, you still have to sit down and talk to kids about their writing. I think that's probably the best thing, is talking about their writing rather than writing extensive comments. Although I, you know, did a lot of more here, you know, I don't see how this fits in and that kind of stuff.
You know. Did you see the students change in your time here? Have they seemed different?
Yeah, I think the students are a lot better students.
Really?
I really do, yeah. And I would say that, and I realize this today, your freshman class is touted as the best and the brightest and the biggest number. But I know when I first started teaching the kids, well, of course I was not a very good teacher either, and so that's probably six, one half dozen the other. But I think the students, yes, the longer I taught, I thought the better quality that Sylvia was doing.
Well, interesting. Good enough. Good to know it's better than the other way.
Oh, I don't think it's going the other way.
And no, I'm saying it'd be better than it's not going the other
way.
Yeah,
no, and I know a lot of people moan and groan about the kids, but I'm telling you. Especially now that I'm in the dean's office and I see what faculty do. I mean, you ask them to do something, you ask them to read something, they don't read it, they don't do what they're supposed to do. It's like, how do they expect their students to read and do what they want them to do? Very interesting.
Being on the other side of the desk.
You know, get something in by the 8th, 2 weeks later. Oh, I still have that in. Yeah, oh sure, just for you.
That's interesting. Who were the presidents and the deans and when you first came here? And I guess who were the movers and shakers? Let's see here.
Okay. When I came here as a faculty wife in 1965, Bob Carter was president. Bob Carter included me in the interview, which when I think about it now, I think he was even interviewing a prospective faculty wife, but anyway.
What do you think he was doing? Why do that?
He was a very controlling kind of person. I don't know, I guess he just wanted to look me over and see if, you know, I was somehow, you know, adversely or positively affect the university. He wasn't here very long.
Huh.
And he had come, he was just new that year, maybe the semester before, and he had, his predecessor, and I don't remember his name now, but the predecessor was living in the president's office, and they were trying to get rid of him, so this Bob Carter, as my understanding, at least the story went, had all the power disconnected from the president's residence, so that guy, the predecessor, did leave. Carter came in, didn't last very long, and then Wattrell, Al Wattrell came in, I don't know if you remember him, and that was in 68, I think I looked it up. And at that time, there was an extremely active organization called Faculty Wives. And that's because in those days, you know, most women, most faculty wives had no careers of their own.
Wow.
And had more time on their hands than I guess they should have. And, were looking for excuses to get away from their children, which I freely admit to doing. So anyway, we had this faculty wives club, and oh, we did lots of interesting things. We had a gourmet club, and I don't know what all. The gourmet club was the standout. At any rate, when President Wattrell came in, I was vice president of the faculty wives, and Lois Kaur, who was married to Irv Kaur, a former professor in speech, now communication department, she was president. So she and I and Linda Lenz was another officer, and I don't remember who the fourth one was, but we were going to call on Carol Wattrell, the new president's wife, and welcome her to Silver Rock, which we did, wearing dresses and white gloves, I want you to know. That memory, I can still see that. Four of us tromping the sidewalk to welcome Carol, who was very gracious. so.
So what, is, what did that seem to you, like to you in retrospect?
Oh man, I thought that was high society, you know. We used to, the president always had, back in those days, instead of an assembly, which has been the practice for Bob Ersol and Bob Smith, Warren G. Warren, and I don't know, before that probably too. But there was a reception in the fall. And we wore long dresses, the women wore long dresses, and of course wore suits, no tuxes.
So for
very formal occasion.
For women faculty, were they wearing dresses as well?
The women faculty?
Were there any?
Oh, there were women faculty. In fact, one woman faculty kind of had her feet in both camps, Rhoda Taylor and Meyer. She was both a faculty wife and a faculty. But other faculty women probably weren't so active or weren't involved in faculty life. Not in my memory, anyway. It was a long time ago, Mark.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So you had Bob Carter, Al Wattrell.
Yeah. And then Al Wattrell got into all kinds of difficulties with state situations. And the guy who did food service, he got the axe, and then Al got the axe. And, oh, there were exciting times when he got the axe.
You said difficulties with state?
There was, I think there was finagling. I don't know if it was intentional, but there were questions about budget.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Wattrell built that Gail Rose building area over the football stadium.
Okay.
Which was for many years referred to as Wattrell's folly, because he built it and then there was some, he had it built and then there was some notion that it was kind of sliding down the hill, so it was not usable for several years. I think they've since propped it up. And then there was something about the food service guy, who he and his wife were friends of mine, but he managed to procure and serve lobster at some event, and everybody talked about the lobster as being an unnecessary expense. Now, everybody who went enjoyed the lobster tremendously, but then it became a bad thing. So ultimately, Wattrell and food service guy and some other people left. Abruptly. I was down camping on Cape Hatteras, as you know, I go down there, and I've been going down there for several years. And we were in a tent, and at one point somebody came, not that you could knock on the tent door, but somebody came to our tent door and said, you know, we had a phone call. Nobody had cell phones back in those days. It was just a pay phone outside the campground storehouse. So my ex-husband went there. Well, it was the latest update on who was president, because it kept changing after Wattrell left. There were different camps, as you might well imagine, who wanted. So one time, this Mark Salmon was in charge, and then another time, for a while, Jim Roberts, who was at that time the vice president for academic affairs, he was in charge. It just kept changing. It was like a soap opera, you know. President today. Well, we don't know. Let's fucking hold me and see. Very interesting. That was back in the 70s, early 70s.
Wow. So, was there somebody more permanent after Wattrell?
More, I don't know what you mean by more permanent.
Well, we you said had, sort of interim folks.
Yeah, we had after Wattrell. Herb Reinhart came in the late 70s. Herb always signed his name Herb, the period, after the Herb Reinhart. So mostly we referred to him as Herb, period. He was not a popular character on campus. He was an extremely demanding personality, very controlling. One evening, 11 o'clock, my phone rang, and it was her period. This was while I was still married.
Was that home?
This was at home.
Wow.
Yeah. And I lived next door to Bob Ersol, the former, who eventually became president. Anyway, he said, I've been trying to call Bob Ersol for 2 hours and I can't get him. Would you go over and knock on his door and get him for me? He said, no, I'm in bed. Which, I mean, this was before I was on board, you know, I was just still a faculty wife, so I thought, thought, oh, my husband's going to get fired and God knows what's going to happen. Anyway, I knew what paper souls were doing because Herb would call them all night long, and so they'd take the phone off the hook. And I mean, there was no way I was going to walk down there anyway after, in the middle of the night. So, but that's the kind of guy he was. So he left, and then there was a Larry Park who served as the interim, and then, gosh, I'm really drawing a blank. That's the choice of aging. Anyway, and then, of course, eventually Bob Abersold, who was serving as Herb's, Larry Park preceded Herb, and then Herb had chosen Bob Abersold as his vice president for academic affairs, and Herb left, and then Bob became president and served for several years, early 80s until, I don't know, when Gene Warren came in, late 90s. 97. And Gene Warren came in, and then of course there was a hoopla with Gene Warren, and then you missed all that
too. Yeah. Lobsters this time?
No. I don't know. He didn't seem to get on too well with the people in Harrisburg, because of course by that time we've all become part of the state system. I mean, when I first came here, we were, as I said, Silver Rock State College. They dropped the teachers, but was still pretty much a teacher's college. And then, of course, in 83, we got the contract uniting all 14 of the state universities, and then, of course, increasing, I think, amounts of control came out of Harrisburg, especially with Judy Hempel. Anyway, Gene Warren didn't apparently get along too well with the people in Harrisburg, so he very abruptly didn't get the power turned off on the president's residence, but was told he had to leave. And of course, he had Bob Smith as his vice president for academic affairs, who then stepped in as president. And then Bob Smith, of course, asked Bill Williams, who was chair of the English department. And I was his assistant chair, that's one job I did forget to mention. I was the assistant chair of the English department for, I don't know, two terms, whatever, while Bill Williams was chair of the English department. But then, of course, he went over to the dark side and became the vice president and provost for academic affairs.
So you've seen some amazing stuff since
you've
been here.
Oh, lots of changes, yeah. But you know, the college still stays here and get students. Being a faculty member is a nice gig.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Let's see. Other people who influenced you or were significant in your time here? And why?
I would say Bill Williams was a huge influence. He knew my family situation and said, "Right, you know, you just have to go get that master's degree," which is, I mean, I was hired without a bachelor's, with just a bachelor's for my quarter-time position, based on 5.5 years of so-called successful high school teaching. That was 15 years prior to that, but anyway. So he, you know, he said, "Oh, go to IUP," because he was at that time in the doctoral program at IUP. And I did, went out to school, and I got to get the PhD. You know, I don't know if you know Bill well enough to know that he would refer to that. That's your ticket, that's your union ticket, he'd say.
What does that mean, your union ticket?
You get your PhD, you're golden. You know, back in those days, they were. Hiring people without PhDs, obviously, but you know, you pretty much have to have one nowadays.
So, when are the wins shipped with that?
I would say in the 90s, definitely by the late 90s. And of course, with all this these performance indicators that have come into being in the last 8 years, I believe. You know, it's just that's one of the performance indicators. How many faculty have PhDs? Crucial now. It wasn't back then so much. I mean, I could have stayed on forever with just a master's degree, but I would never have had any promotions. I would remain probably an assistant professor. I moved to assistant professor without a PhD, but couldn't have gone any further. So anyway, he was a big influence, and while I was at IUP, I met Jim Strickland, who also was really helpful to me. because I just get all bent out of shape. So I can't do this. I have three kids. I can't, you know, I don't know, I'm stupid. I just, and both Bill and Jim were just, okay. And Jim in particular, what if I had a big paper, and particularly with a dissertation, which gambles on me, because during the course of, I've flown through the coursework, got my comps out of the way, did my orals, collected my data, and then my mother died, and one of my kids broke her neck. It was just like a whole bunch of stuff, and I thought, you know what, I don't care. But anyway, Jim kept saying, just free write, you know. So anyway, eventually I got the dissertation. But those two guys, and then Jason Gondravy also, she and I had many a trip back and forth from IUP together, because we took classes together. So kind of served as each other's support.
So how did you pull off that balancing act? I mean, it sounds extraordinary in retrospect, the kids, you know, the PhD. And when I did it, just not being married and having any kids was so hard.
Yeah, I don't know, Mark. My mother, my dad died very abruptly when my mother was, 50. And right before my brother was going off to college. He had scholarships to Yale, but not full scholarships. Anyway, money was very precarious. I was a sophomore in high school. And I guess I watched my mother cope with all the stuff she coped with, and I kept thinking, well, my mother did this, you know. So, I don't know, it just happened. I had a lot of, as I said, encouragement from people in the department. Terrific neighbors. Very, very supportive. Because by that time I'd lived here long enough that I established a lot of really good friendships. Very encouraging.
In retrospect, are you glad you muscled through it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I don't know. I don't know what else I would have done. Because I sort of thought originally, well, maybe I'd go back to Illinois. But, by that time, I didn't have that much family left. I still had a lot of friends there, but, not the kind of network that
sure.
enabled me to, I think, experience the kind of success that I did here.
Community, nice. Mm-hmm. I guess we can do some of these wrap-up questions. Were there any major events or activities while you were here, academic or cultural or building projects or weather events or national events that linked up?
Well, let's see, building projects. I think one of the saddest things that I witnessed here was the tearing down of the chapel. I don't know if anybody's told you about the chapel.
Where was it?
Right across from DSB, where the alumni house is now.
Uh-huh.
Beautiful stone building. I have a couple of stones from there. If you ever want to see them, you can come to my house and show you the chapel stones.
Where did they tear it down?
Well, the interior was condemned.
Oh.
And the state school, no money to build it. And, not a whole lot of wealthy alumni back then. They were all teachers. They didn't have the big bucks to endow. So they tore that down. They did manage to save a beautiful dogwood tree that was kind of like in a little courtyard. And the next year the dogwood died, which I always think was kind of a protest to, killing this building, I'm going to die too. So I thought that was a very, very sad thing. The stained glass windows in the Pennsylvania room, North Hall, are from the chapel.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why did the state school have a chapel?
I have no idea. Well, other than... like when I was an undergraduate, we had, assembly. We had to go to assembly every Wednesday, and they took attendance. If you didn't show up, you got in trouble. I have no idea what kind of trouble you got into, but you had to be there. You had to sit in your seat. So I assume it was probably something like that, because there was, a God-fearing group that established these state schools. I'm sure the chapel seemed important. So that was a sad thing. When I first came here, the university stopped at Morrow Field House. There was none of this part of campus was here.
Really?
No spots, no Vincent, no PT building, no Eisenberg, no residence halls. None of that stuff was here. So it was interesting. In fact, the Jim Roberts, one of the guys that was academic vice president for a while, had a farm down here, south of the library. This was all farmland.
What did he grow?
We tomatoes, gooseberries. I used to give my mother gooseberries, and my mother made gooseberry jam. Pie, gooseberry pie.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now his farm is?
Now he has a place up. Actually, his farm was on the other side of the road, but there was a farmhouse there, and I think he farmed some of his land. He's got a place up north of Harrisville, which is another favorite story of mine after. It kind of dates back to one of your other questions. I was talking to a local person, what I thought was a local person, not too long after I moved here. And he said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Oh, I'm from Chicago." He said, "Oh, that's pretty far away." And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Are you from around here?" He said, "Oh, no, no." I said, "Where are you from?" Harrisville. I'm super back to Harrisville. Way far away.
So for those who don't know Harrisville, how far is Harrisville by car?
Harrisville is probably, I don't know, 5 miles. 5 miles.
You turned me on to Penn Gold ice cream when I first got here.
That's where Harrisville is. That has the Penn Gold ice cream store.
How long has that place been in business?
Since my kids were little, probably before that. I don't know. Forever.
You have a favorite flavor over there?
Well, my kids used to love the tea berry. I don't go in there. I've been in there for quite a while. I like anything with chocolate.
Good to know. Other memorable events?
We had a weather event when I was, I think we were still in Eisenberg. We had a little earthquake. I was in my office just by myself, and there weren't very many other people around, and I kind of felt this tremor, and I looked, and I thought, the filing cabinets shaking. And sure enough, we had a little bit of an earthquake here. Not enough to do any damage, but it did shake the building. So that was kind of exciting. The other thing was 911.
Where were you?
I was, I had just begun in the deeds office as assistant to former Dean Bill McKinney. And we were having our first college meeting of all the departments over at Swope. And we had ordered pizza, as we still do. And Bill McKinney had a little TV in his office. And he came out of the office. He said, "Come here, you gotta watch this." And we went in and, you know, watched the second plane go into the building. And then he got a call from Old Main saying that all the administrators were to meet there. I think they were gonna, nobody knew what was happening. We didn't know that we were gonna be attacked, and I guess we were gonna make a plan of what to do. Well, I don't know if you do. All going to get attacked. Anyway, he said, "You go ahead and conduct the college, or just have the pizza and, you know, say what, you know, welcome, blah, 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 whatever." So I had had this student, Rick, in a couple of English classes, one where he was just an abject failure, didn't care, hated the class, hated me, blah, blah, blah. Then I had him again in another class a couple of years later, and he really did a turnaround. And so I really got a kick out of this Rick. Probably know him because he became a graduate student.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can't think of his last name right now. Anyway, he was delivering pizza for Cabarro's. So I went out to meet him at Swope, and because I had the money for the check or whatever. He said, "I'll never forget this. This is like part of 911. He said, "The whole world's falling apart, and here I am delivering fucking pizzas." And I just thought, yeah, that pretty much says it all. So anyway, that was a very memorable thing, trying to cope with that and trying to get students to get them through the day, get everybody through the day. The days, actually.
And then we had that plane crash out here in Pennsylvania.
Yes,
was close by.
Right. And of course, that was even scarier because it was so close to home.
How far away is that?
From here? I've never been there. I know they have a nice memorial going there, but I don't know, a couple hours, I'd say. I don't have to tell you.
I guess the second last one. What, if anything, you missed about being in Sacramento, though?
Well,
back.
Obviously, I did miss it. I missed being around students, which unfortunately in the dean's office, you're not really seeing that many students, and sometimes the ones you see are the fun ones. but I still see some of my college grading students. In fact, I saw one last night. I went to a concert over in Swope and saw one of my students. Just, you know, it's really a pleasure to see these kids, to see how they mature, you know, from beginning freshman when they're really wide-eyed and they're really cool and become really cool with everything and, you know, do well. So that's exciting. And I miss being around faculty. Just the academic community, I missed. Yeah. So it's nice to be back.
You like being gay?
Most days. Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
What's the best part about being dean?
No papers, right?
And the throne you get to sit on and the crown you get to wear?
Well, you know what? I'm not, I don't have a throne, I don't have a crown, I have terrific help with Helen and Amy. I'm not getting paid as much as I were, as I was getting paid as a full professor.
Really?
I'm very interested.
Wow, you were revealing state secrets here. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
People get nasty with me. I could just say, you know what? You're not paying me enough for this job.
Holy cow. All right, the last one. The global question. Anything you'd like for current, future Rock community members to know? How would you like to be remembered? Aside from that zipper story.
Well, it's too late to convert you, but I really think that... people, faculty, staff should make it a point to live near the university. Now it's for an economic reason. I can't imagine what people are paying in gas just to commute from Pittsburgh or Granbury or Youngstown or whatever. But I think you miss a lot by not. I mean, personally, I live two miles from here, and I know there are times I think I'm not driving into town for something. I missed a lot of stuff by that. If I lived 25 or 30 or 40 miles away, I know I wouldn't become involved in not only the university community, but the community. I mean, if I hadn't lived here, I would never know about Leakey and Sudsy and all the stuff I learned as a faculty wife and being involved in local church communities and other activities. And I was an active member of Women's Club for many years. So, you know, that's how you know what's going on and learn a lot. So I would say that would be one piece of advice I would give. The other one is, it's a great place to be. Got a nice small town atmosphere. Other than the fact that there's no big body of water here, I think this is a perfect place to live.
That's your Chicago for now?
Yeah. I spent a lot of time in Lake Michigan.
That's great. Anything else you want to add before we close it down? That was cool. I feel like I've learned so much here. I want to get some chipped ham. I mean, maybe completely hungry.
Oh, you got it.